Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Everyday Anarchism. I am your host, Graham Culbertson, and my guest today is a truly eminent film writer named David Thompson, and we're here to discuss the new book, A Sudden Flicker of Light. So, David, thank you for joining me, and can you just start by telling the people who you are and what this book is?
Well, as you may gather, I was born in England. I'm English and American. I've written a lot of books, many of which are about film and cinema and related areas. And this book is a one-volume revisionist history of the whole thing, the medium of movies. And clearly it doesn't cover everything, but I try to trace what I think are the most important trends in the history, and I do that really to try and get a grasp on where we are now in this extremely complicated, perilous time when we are more dependent on what we call media than probably at any time in human history. And I think we all know that we feel very uneasy about how far we can and should trust these instruments that record us and convey us and often penetrate our lives. Obviously, we can talk about it, but it's a book that explores my own feelings of uneasiness about film. I was a film maniac from the age of about four, in that I don't think there was anything in my life as a kid, as a youth, that meant as much to me and excited me and fulfilled me and drew me on. And I don't think I would be a writer if I hadn't started thinking how to write about films. I went to see probably too many films as a kid. And I think it alarmed my mother. She went with me sometimes to see films, so she was not opposed to it. But I think she saw obsession and added in an attempt to maybe tame or control that obsession. She said to me, and I'm talking about when I was like 13, 14 sort of age, well, if you're going to go and see all these films, I want you to write something about them. And thus it was, I began writing what I felt about what had happened to me in a movie theater. And I'm still doing that, but in a rather more sophisticated way than I was doing it then. But I'm deeply grateful to her for sort of just really telling me, and not quite ordering, but making it clear that it was part of the deal, that one could think about movies, think about what was happening as one watched, and write about it, and maybe be useful for other people and enrich their experience. So this book is part of that, and I'm at what is said to be a mature age of 85. So, you know, I don't foresee that I will write that many more books about film, although I've written a lot already, and I have other subjects, film subjects, in mind for the future. So anyway, I hope that addresses your question.
Yes, it absolutely does. Let me say a couple of things for the listeners about the book from my perspective so they can get a sense. So first of all, it absolutely is, which I didn't realize it was going to be, a history of the movies. So if you are like me and you've taught like a film history class and you get a textbook that starts with, you know, these experimentations that lead to Lumiere and the Méliès and Edison, and then you go through Germany and Hollywood and New Hollywood, that stuff is all in here. I don't know, if you don't know that story well, how well it would go for you reading this book, seeing as I've not just read those books but taught them before. But it really does carry you through the entire history of film. As you say, not all of it, but no one can cover all of it.
Right.
It has an essayistic perspective, which is to say David Thompson thinking through and working through the perspective, and that's my favorite kind of book.
Yeah.
And the book suggests, and this is where I can turn it over to you again, that seeing like a camera, or thinking like a film, or however you want to say, adopting the gaze of cinema, has in some way, some crucial and important and political way, changed how we see the world, how we see ourselves. And, you know, we don't need to talk too much about Trump just yet, although we can talk about Trump as much as you want. In some way, the history of cinema runs right through Hitler, and it runs right through Trump. And those of us like you and myself who are cinema obsessives and are always watching movies and talking about movies, it's time for us to reckon with the connection between our this media or art form that we are so in love with and the current world, which we are so out of love with. And you're arguing that there's a deeper connection than those of us who want to spend our time in the dark watching movies would like to think.
Yeah, I mean, one can't escape the fact that when film began, it did something that photography had done for approximately 50 years before film came into being, moving film. It showed us our reality, and photography and then movie showed us places we'd heard about but had never seen and would never see but for cameras. And it put us in touch with the reality, and beyond question, it educated us about these places. I mean, we saw how people lived in the Arabian desert, on the Siberian plateau. We saw what Antarctica looked like. And all of these things had been legend, really, only before photography. And everyone was excited and felt they were coming to terms with their world in a very special way. All true, and had a dynamic effect. But then I think something began to seep into our consciousness, which was that we were spectators. And let me give you a sort of an example of what I'm talking about. Imagine you are sitting in a chair on a lawn in a beautiful, exotic, tropical garden in India. And the day is perfect. It's hot, but not too hot. And you see an infant playing on the lawn, just alone, playing on the lawn, chattering to himself or herself. And you look around. There don't seem to be any parents around. So you sort of accept that you have a notional responsibility towards that child. That becomes sharpened when you see something stirring in the bushes at the end of the garden, and you're not sure what it is, but then you realize it's a cobra slithering through the grass, the undergrowth, and approaching the child. So that you realize and recognize that your responsibility could suddenly become urgent and critical. And while you are as afraid of snakes as anyone, you stand up, you look for a stick to beat off the cobra, if that works, and there are no sticks. So you entertain the prospect and then the reality that you yourself will have, maybe with your bare hands, to hold the cold scales of the snake and feel its muscles surging, and you're going to battle it, and it's trying to bite you. And it's a sort of life and death situation. And you are protecting this child. You don't know the child, it's certainly not your child, but, you know, if it's you and the child in the garden, then you have a responsibility. Okay, take the same situation, except that in this case, you are watching a film, and the film involves a cobra coming out of the grass, going up to the baby, and you tell yourself, oh, I really am anxious for that child, but what can I do? I can't get into the screen. I can't affect the reality. Therefore, I can't do anything but just watch it. So the suspense of the narrative situation becomes intense. It may be that the snake will simply pass by, ignoring the child. And you say to yourself, oh, why did I assume the snake was an enemy, was hostile? Maybe it will attack the child. And maybe what you're seeing will turn into the elements of a horror film, nearly. But you're a spectator. You're watching. You do not feel you can be involved. Now take that situation and relate it to more or less where we are today. And I will generalize, but I think you can see where I'm going. We, living in what is theoretically a free country, and theoretically, the greatest country on earth, which we are told regularly, we feel ourselves beset by and surrounded by problems. And, you know, these are very large problems, and they have to do with what is happening with our climate, our weather, and what is that going to do to the way we can breathe on Earth, can we survive heat waves, all those kind of things. What is happening with the thing we call AI? What is happening with the fact that there is still, whatever we may have been trying to do about it, there is still an immense gulf between the people who have and the people who don't have? And is that a problem we should ignore, or one we should try to solve? Now, those are just the sketch of the things that frighten us and the problems that frighten us. we have blundered into an extra, which is that, let me put this as gently as I can, the person who is supposed to be our leader seems to us most of the time, or all of the time, you take your pick, seems to be thoroughly dishonest in that there's nothing he says that you can rely on. He seems to be corrupt in that he is using his power and his position to make himself wealthier, richer, more elevated. And he seems to have no respect for the very elements of the Constitution or the set of beliefs and the system of law that we have treasured in this country. And what are we going to do about it? And if you're like me, you wake up every day and you check your phone, your screen, your personal screen, you check your screen to see if he's still there. Because something in you wants him not to be there. And you know, and you would claim, and you would defend the argument that really he should not be there. He was elected, but he is not doing the job for which he was elected, and he doesn't seem to care a damn about the country and about us. He is the total narcissist. What are we going to do about it? And we feel powerless. Now, I argue in the book that the feeling of powerlessness and futility and the fatalism that comes from it is very much involved with the lifelong training we have had in being just a spectator, as if the whole world is there for our entertainment and amusement, as opposed to being a world of which we are a part and have a responsibility to and the chance of taking action. So I think that in a terrible way, the media have becalmed us and they have persuaded us that we have no agency, that our responsibility is a fatuous concoction as opposed to something we should and can be involved in and take action for. Now, that's very general, and I went on too long, but you get the feeling.
Yeah, and I'm completely convinced by this. I mean, reading your book, I was thinking, you know, I mean, that people will always be referencing Hitler in conversations like this, but Hitler obviously is important to this story. But I was also thinking about the most famous sort of like democratic spectacle in history is the Roman Colosseum and the Circus Maximus, and it's there, and the emperor is in a certain way performing for the crowd, and how much say the crowd has and whether the gladiator is executed or whatever, the historians are debating, but in some way democracy is being staged there as spectacle, but it's also very immediate. It also is very much not the day-to-day problems of solving the problems for the people of the Roman Empire. So it's democracy as spectacle. And reading your book, it struck me that it's no surprise that the most powerful authoritarian or even totalitarian governments in history arose during the age of film, because you can stage democracy as spectacle, but without even needing people to get up and go down to the Colosseum. It's one step removed. Sorry, go ahead.
No, well, I mean, I was just going to say that it's an alarming, but I think unquestionable fact that film has appealed most to authoritarian leaders, totalitarians, fascism. Lenin, Stalin, Mussolini, Hitler, the most obvious cases, people who loved cinema. And I think you can argue that all of them, in their own ways, grasped and accepted that they were performers on the nation's screen. And, you know, of a fairly modestly impressive figure like Hitler, Adolf Hitler, became a titan on camera. And the German filmmakers, supposedly documentary filmmakers who were covering him, I think understood this. And they glamorized him and they made a hero of him. And the liberal leaders, the democratic leaders, it's not that they've been unaware of film, but they've been much more modest in their use of it, and they haven't seen it as an extension of their ego. And I mean, clearly with our president, this is a man who seems to spend the huge majority of his time either being on camera, and compared with previous presidents, he has an insatiable appetite just to be seen and to be on camera. And I think instinctively he understands the propaganda value of just being on. He seems inescapable, incompetent maybe, dishonest maybe, but absolutely central to our experience, our consciousness at the moment. And apart from that, what does he do? He watches television. He boasts about it. He doesn't read books. He isn't into the sort of dialectical, rational, thoughtful pursuit of issues. He watches television, and frequently he watches himself on television, or he watches people talking about him on television. It's narcissism taken to a degree that we've never really known before.
Yeah, I mean, but I would also like to add, he watches his acolytes and surrogates on television, and he fires them if he doesn't like their performance on television.
If their ratings sink, yes. So do they.
It really, and this is, I mean, I definitely think I frustrated some friends and neighbors during the whole, you know, Russia investigation and the impeachment trials, and now like the confirmation of certain people. You know, they'll wake up in the morning and be like, did you see what happened at the confirmation hearing? And I just say, no, I didn't. That's not a movie I want to watch. I can tell you about the Ozu movie I watched yesterday, but I don't know what happened in the confirmation hearing, because I, rightly or wrongly, I'm not interested in democracy as totalitarian cinema, but to a certain extent, that means I'm withdrawing from what democracy is right now.
Well, for sure. But you know, who knows where we're going? The next few months, I think, are going to be pretty critical and decisive. Certainly, the period before the next general election is going to be crucial. And not just for us, because I think the whole world is waiting to see how this issue and this personage is resolved. And you know, he's an old man, and he does seem to be aging almost as one watches, as if exposure and our eyeballs are gradually wearing him away. But we're joking about it, and I think you and I know, and I think most of the people who are listening know, this is a flat-out desperate situation.
Yeah, and, you know, so Bernie's charisma is in some ways like an anti-charisma, but it still is incredible to watch him. But this, I followed and, of course, supported, although I'm not from New York, Mamdani's candidacy. Yeah. And I like his policies. And then now that he's mayor, it's complicated. But what I heard from people, and I'm not on any social media right now, except I think LinkedIn, and I have an Instagram account for the podcast that I don't use. I heard that what made the reason why Mamdani is governor, is mayor of New York, in part is that we're in a democratic socialist movement in blue areas. But mostly people just said he's just so good on camera. That's just like, that's, we just need someone better, more, who has more of that like primal, or maybe I should say like primate charisma on camera than Donald Trump.
Well, there you are. And, and you know, I find, I talk to some people who say, oh, well, you know, this is a terrible time, but there's an election coming. And when the election comes, we can get them out and us in, and we can revert to some kind of idealistic version of the American plan and project. And it will be like, well, I don't know, let's say it'll be like Jack Kennedy or Clinton or whatever. I think that's a terribly suspect line of thinking, because I think that what has been established by this president is the primacy of the photographed leader, the thing you were talking about. And yes, Mamdani, Ocasio-Cortez, other people we don't even know about yet, are going to depend upon how persuasive they are on camera. And almost as if we were unaware of it happening, you suddenly look back at, you know, just the last 70 or 80 years, let's say the post-World War II era, and you see how leadership and politics and national purpose have really been altered by the coverage of it in the media, and the fact that that is the way we understand what is happening to us.
Yeah, I as we're speaking, the Obama LISC was recently opened, Obama's Presidential Library, and I just saw a headline, I didn't look into it, that I guess as sort of an ironic joke, Obama wore his tan suit to an event, which I don't know if any listeners remember this. I only vaguely remember, but one time during the Obama presidency, he wore a tan suit when maybe it would have been considered slightly more proper not to have worn a tan suit. Right. And Fox News just covered the tan suit for weeks. I mean, I think they covered it more than they covered Obamacare. And yeah. So yeah. This yeah. is yeah. Obama's legislation seems to be much less important in the memory than the suit that he wore.
Well, you know, I mean, I think this is what is, I wouldn't say original in my book, but I think it's why it's the heart of the book. This is not a book that says some film directors are better than others. I touch on that. But the real subject of this book is what has been happening to our understanding of our world and ourselves because of the media. And I think that all too often we overlook what the films are about in the sense of what they are really conveying. And take an example. I make the case in the book that the Godfather films are probably the most widely admired American films of the last 50 years or so. Mm-hmm. They were hugely successful commercially. They won prizes. They are fabulously well made. But what are they about? In my opinion, and I've watched the films many times, and I've watched people watching the films many times, they are about the feeling on the part of men who don't have a great deal of significance in the world to be part of an organization, a family that does have power. And I think they are an intense male fantasy. I emphasize male because, you know, for great films, if that's what they are, they really treat women appallingly. Most of the time, they are just sex objects or they are shut out of the room. You remember a key image of The Godfather is Kay's wistful face as the door closes and she's shut out. This is it's a world, the Corleone world, that endorses what is still a male attitude, which is that women are noisy, pests, over-emotional, so they don't deserve a place in any serious council about what's going on, like the family. You know, I think that a film enthusiast, a film critic, a film writer, a teacher has to deal with this conundrum. The Godfather is truly beautifully made. The writing, the acting, the camera work, the decor, the music. You could watch them forever, and some people do. They watch them almost like once a year, you know. But what are they about? They are, I think, about a longing for powerless men to feel they have some power because they're part of a group, a gang. The gang is a profound emotional grail in a lot of American movies. And I think that we have a gangster in charge. And I don't think that's incidental. I think it's related to the history of the media.
Yeah, I think all of that, I completely agree with all of that. I'll just throw out briefly, you know, Goodfellas and The Wolf of Wall Street have this same problem, although The Godfather is the most austere and rigorous version of it, I would say.
No, I agree. Scorsese I think Scorsese is enormously talented, but he doesn't seem really happy doing anything except making gangster pictures. And I find there's something unsettling about that.
Yeah, and it's clear in these movies his the official position of all of those movies that this is a vacuous, empty, immoral life. And then the undercurrent of how these movies is made is that this is the ultimate fantasy that we should all want. Exactly. And all of these movies. Yeah.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah.
I want to turn, since we're, you know, we're over halfway done now. And there's so much in this book. So a film that comes up in this book that I want to talk about a little bit more because it's a very important film to me. It's called Meet John Doe. And
oh yeah,
listeners, you should watch it immediately if you can. I mean, it's one of the greatest American movies. It's by Frank Capra, who is one of the people who invents Hollywood cinema as we know it. And Meet John Doe, just to briefly sketch the plot for people who haven't seen it, it's essentially a movie in which society is mobilized in a way that I would call anarchism, in that basically the problems of America in the Depression are solved or going to be solved by people just working together and helping one another in these John Doe clubs. The giant machinery of the New Deal seems to have not been mentioned. We're going to run America as a commune of neighborhoods. There's two problems with it. One, the guy who starts this movement is fake. He's not real. He's a media plant. So the person who has inspired everyone to be neighborly and kind and practice mutual aid is a mouthpiece. And the second thing is he's a mouthpiece for a reporter who works for a tycoon who thinks that he can become an American Hitler, not in the name of totalitarianism, but in the name of mutual aid and neighborly. He's going to be the chief neighbor, the first neighbor. And I thought this was a movie quite early. It's 1940 or so.
Yep.
That is absolutely getting at the relationship between democracy, fascism, and the media. I mean, this is 80 years before your book, but they're trying to work it out and they don't know how.
No, I completely agree. I mean, still to this day, the interpretation of Frank Capra's career, and incidentally, let's say Frank Capra is the real article here, that he was born in Sicily, came to America as a child. The films that are talked about as the great Capra films are still Mr. Deeds Goes to Town and Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. And they're very good, entertaining pictures. But the film that largely flopped, the film we're talking about that you brought up, Meet John Doe, I think is the most profound of all of them, and a very complicated, disturbing film. And, you know, Gary Cooper is this bum, virtually, who is made into a national hero. And Gary Cooper was always enormously appealing, so that we warm to him. We see how he's being manipulated. And yet, it's very hard to deal with him, to make up our mind what we feel about him. And I agree with you. It's a very, very insightful picture about the real political, philosophical issues that face a country that is trying to be the best democracy there has ever been. And more than that, the most civilized and humane democracy there has ever been. And that really is the American project. And whatever I have said in this conversation that is critical of America, let me just say that I chose to come to America. I'm English, but I'm an American citizen. I believe in the American project. In many, many ways, it seems to me as a project to be an advancement and an improvement upon the situation in the United Kingdom that I grew up with. I love the American idea. I want it to work. But it has immense problems. And I think that we face a situation where at last this country has to absorb socialism at the very least. I think it's the only way ahead. And it's clear that many people in this country regard socialism as a plague. And they will do everything they can to resist it and avoid it. And it may be that that's where the final civil war has to be fought. And I'm not saying that lightly. I think it's a potentially catastrophic situation.
Yeah, I mean, this is more related. What I'm about to say is more related to other projects I'm working on than cinema, or just my general project is sort of like, you could call it socialism with American characteristics. And the Voltairine de Cleyre and Emma Goldman, who are the two, I would say, the two most famous American anarchists, at least as that are accepted as part of the anarchist movement. Because I mean, Emerson and Thoreau are anarchists in my book, but they're not part of the anarchist movement. Voltairine de Cleyre and Emma Goldman both say, you know, socialism, anarchism, and the Declaration of Independence are all compatible. You can have an anarchist American socialism. And Voltairine de Cleyre has a great essay where she says very clearly, like, if you start talking about socialism to Americans, the way they talk about socialism in Europe, the Americans are going to think that you're tyrannical. But if you locate socialism in neighborliness, self-reliance, mutual aid, all of these things that accord with our sort of New England vision of ourselves, which is why it's not a surprise that Bernie Sanders comes from Vermont, that we need a rugged New England socialism that is compatible with our American sense of ourselves. At least that's Voltairine de Cleyre's argument, and I'm quite sympathetic to it.
Absolutely. And I don't know how we negotiate it through. I mean, one of the things we've not mentioned so far, but has affected me strongly. The Great Britain, where I was born and raised, was a thoroughly racist society. It didn't know it, and it would not have owned up to it. But when the situation in the country reached a crisis where people of color were literally introduced into the country to do jobs that white people didn't really line up to do, a lot of unrest and unease occurred. I would say that in Britain, largely through just intermarriage, a process of reconciliation between the races and between the colors has been underway. And it's not without huge problems, but it is underway, I think. What strikes me about America is that for all the legislation that occurred in the late 50s and the 60s, this country is in the process of reverting to a violent racism. And I don't know how we deal with that. Because we've tried in the sort of obvious conventional ways. We passed legislation. We passed the Voting Rights Act, which is a pretty modest act, but still is something. And it's now being rescinded bit by bit. And who knows what will happen at the next elections we have in terms of processes of intimidation and legal obstruction that is going to really try to isolate the electorate into people of one color, white, who will vote our kind of way for the people who want that sort of end. And I think the racist issue in this country is just lethal.
Yeah, I mean, no, you're absolutely right. I certainly have no argument against that. I would say just my brief, like, you know, student of American history thing would be to say the traditional bargain for every new group of immigrants has been you're going to be discriminated against and sort of lumped in with African Americans. And then over time, if you accept the right cultural norms, you can be sort of baptized with whiteness. And this has happened with every group, I would say, at this point, with the exception of Muslims. And Muslims and Black people are now the eternal internal enemy. And even the Voting Rights Act was an attempt to give Black communities in Southern states their own representatives, and just the idea of their own even the Voting Rights Act accepted that social and cultural integration was not going to come. And so the people who, you know, struck down the Voting Rights Act were able to make good, common sense, sensible American democratic arguments. You know, we are all represented by Congress.
Yeah.
And the fact that that's not true is less a reason, I would think, to keep the Voting Rights Act, and more a reason to say the kind of thing you just said, which is this country is culturally, emotionally unwilling to integrate Black people. It just is unwilling, and no amount of legislation can overcome that.
Yeah. No, I mean, and we kid ourselves, and we all do this, but we kid ourselves when we say there's been so much progress. And sure, there has been so much progress, but it's sort of window dressing. And it doesn't touch the nature of the disease, which is really, I think, what it is. You know? Yeah.
Yeah, and I guess the other half of that thing I'm saying is, and I'm following this argument made by Randolph Bourne, who wrote this essay. I don't remember the name of the essay. I'll try and put a link to it. And basically, he says that American culture is a deal where, as long as you're from Europe, you can be welcomed as an American, but only if you give up whatever culture you came with. And he actually mentions Hollywood movies, even though he's writing in the teens. He says, if you'll replace whatever your folk stories or, you know, your ancient patriotic myth is with Hollywood movies, you can be accepted as an American. So on the one hand, it's terrible because Black people are excluded. On the other hand, it's terrible because the richness of world culture, every world culture is welcome in America.
That's right.
As long as you don't hang on to that world culture. Yeah. And that's
right. Yeah. And also there are horrible ways in which the political idealism has become, bit by bit, has become a manifestation of an advertised society. Yeah. The weight of advertising, which rational people say, oh, I don't take the ad seriously. Don't kid yourself. They pound away at us all the time. And they have a whole series of lying assumptions that begins with some people are more attractive than others. They move on to some products will change your life. Therefore, you are encouraged to dream. The whole notion of the American dream is a version of Las Vegas. You know when you go to Las Vegas that your chance of winning is at best about 20%. In American society, your chance of winning is a lot less than 20%. And more people are failing in American society. And they feel wretched because emotionally they feel they have let themselves down and they have let the dream down. The dream doesn't really exist. It's a promotion scheme by politics, by advertising, and we have to step away from it. We have to find a different kind of reality. I don't know how we do that. And to that extent, my book is sort of anguished. You know, I mean, we're not talking about a situation where we can see the way to deal with it. I don't see the way to deal with it.
Yeah. I like to end these episodes with a suggestion of a way out. And I agree with you. I don't see an obvious one. So for me, and this has been pretty painful for me, I have taken refuge in what I would call, you know, sometimes it's called slow cinema. Paul Schrader calls it transcendental cinema. I would call it democratic or non-authoritarian cinema. When I watch the films of Tarkovsky and Ozu and Hu Hsiao-shen, these filmmakers who are gazing on the world with their attempt to say, look, you look at what I'm looking at, I being Hu Hsiao-shen, but you think what you want to think and you feel what you want to feel. This solves the problem for me personally. I don't think the cinemas are about to start showing only Ozu and no more Kurosawa, who is, I want to say, I'm not talking about the quality of film here. It's not that Kurosawa, I think Ozu is a better filmmaker than Kurosawa, but let's say but let's say they're both amazing filmmakers, but one of them is a tyrant. Kurosawa is, in that he wants you to see and feel certain things, and Ozu doesn't try to direct your emotions and your thoughts.
Exactly. But I mean, you know, you're touching upon a strain of cinema which has been there from the beginning, and in different parts of the world now is still functioning, and there are still remarkable films made, but they are not films that trade on fantasy. Fantasy is not the basis of the films. They offer real ways of looking at the world that are filled with doubt and the uncertainty. And there is an incredible maniacal certainty about American films and American media. There are some exceptions, but our films end conclusively. And we are enabled to feel, because of that, that satisfactory conclusions have been arrived at. They are not being arrived at.
Yeah, this is Bertolt Brecht's theory that you should, you know, leave the cinema, you know, angry at the state of the world and wanting to change it, not relieved at the ending of the movie and pacified. But that's, you know, good luck. I mean, and Meet John Doe does that. Unlike Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, and that's why Meet John Doe is a flop. That's why it's a flop.
And, you know, it is very interesting biographically that Capra, who came to the country really as the sort of classic immigrant, not very much means, educated himself, became a huge success as a filmmaker, seemed in the 1930s to be essentially liberal, turned and became very conservative after the war. It's sort of like that moment in Citizen Kane where Kane is charged with being a communist or a fascist, and he solves that dilemma by saying, I'm an American.
All right. David Thompson, author of A Sudden Flicker of Light, this has been such a pleasure. Anything else you would like to say before we end here?
No, I mean, I would just thank you for leading the conversation into what I think is where my book is aimed, which is really what the movies are about, not how well they're done, how well they did at the box office, what prizes they won. And I think in America particularly, it's about an immense conflict between fantasy and reality.
Yeah, and the fantasy, that's what America, at least in the 20th century, was best known for.
Totally.
Was selling the fantasy. Yes. And it has come home to roost.
That did happen. Yes.
All right, thank you so much.
Well, I thank you.